From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, Susan Stamberg reflects on her years behind the microphone. She's written a new book that includes excerpts of her interviews from the past 20 years. Also today, a writer's formative years. We talk with novelist Muriel Spark, the author of The Prime of Miss Jean Brody. She has a new memoir about her life leading up to the publication of her first book, which was 36 years and 18 novels ago. And Maureen Corrigan reviews King of Cards by Robert Ward. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President Clinton spent the day lobbying for his budget and deficit reduction plan. It faces its first crucial test in Congress tomorrow when the House of Representatives is scheduled to vote on the tax and spending package. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
The president lobbied members of the Congressional Black Caucus over breakfast and business executives over lunch, and he made more than a dozen phone calls to Democratic lawmakers who are still leery of voting for his plan because it includes controversial tax hikes and, some complain, not enough spending cuts. A compromise to meet those concerns was under discussion. It would put assurances in the bill that if spending for entitlement programs like Social Security, Medicare, and food stamps exceeded their targets, Congress would do something to avoid increasing the deficit. The president has ruled out giving an Oval Office address to rally support for his plan before the House votes, but aides say it's likely he'll speak to the nation before the plan comes up in the Senate, where the president faces an even tougher fight. At the White House, I'm Mara Liasson.
The Senate voted today to stop political action committees from contributing to candidates for federal office. The amendment expanded the ban on PAC contributions to apply to candidates from both the Senate and the House. If the ban were found to be unconstitutional, the amendment would still lower the amount a PAC could donate from the current $5,000 to $1,000. It would also limit total PAC contributions to 20% of a candidate's total fundraising. Democrats also narrowly defeated a Republican effort to pull funding from a provision that would offer taxpayer subsidies to congressional candidates who agree to limit their overall campaign spending. The German parliament has voted by an overwhelming majority to change its constitution to restrict the number of refugees applying for political asylum. Deirdre Berger reports from Bonn.
After a marathon 12-hour session, delegates from the ruling conservative coalition and some members of the opposition joined to vote 521 to 132 to tighten laws on political asylum. If approved by the upper house of parliament, as expected, the new law will allow immediate deportation of most asylum seekers to the last country of transit as of July 1st. Approximately 40,000 refugees a month are coming to Germany and asking for political asylum. About 10,000 demonstrators in Bonn protested the new law with numerous street blockades, bringing traffic to a standstill in the government center of the capital. The demonstrations were largely peaceful, but 13 police were injured in a short clash with demonstrators trying to break through police lines to reach the Bundestag. For National Public Radio, this is Deirdre Berger in Bonn.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 24 points to close at a record 3,540. The NASDAQ Composite Index was up 9 points at 704. This is NPR News. Reports from the northern Bosnian town of Maglé said that Bosnian Serb troops are keeping the town under a steady artillery bombardment. The Reuters news agency said that shells are falling in the town every 10 minutes and that every house has been damaged. Muslim and Croat troops who are defending the town say that food and medicine are running out and that UN relief convoys have been turned back by the heavy shelling. The UN High Commissioner for Refugees said that the 32,000 civilians in the area are in danger and that another refugee catastrophe could be on its way. A new study from France appears to solve a problem that could have delayed the introduction of the abortion drug RU486 into the United States. NPR's Joe Palca has details.
In order to use RU486 to terminate a pregnancy, it must be taken with another drug called a prostaglandin. Until now, physicians usually gave women prostaglandins by injection. But the injectable form of prostaglandin is not approved by the U.S. Food and Drug Administration. The new study, published in this week's New England Journal of Medicine, shows that a prostaglandin taken as a pill works just as well. In tests involving 900 women, the success rate was as high as 98.7%. The oral form of prostaglandin is already available in the U.S. market. That means one less hurdle for supporters of RU486, who are seeking FDA approval to make the French drug available in this country. In Washington, I'm Joe Palca reporting.
Many U.S. economists are predicting that economic growth will pick up a bit later this year, but most are not as optimistic as they were in February. The National Association of Business Economists said its quarterly survey found that growth forecasts were lower than they were in February, before President Clinton's stimulus package died in the Senate. The association's forecasters said they expected economic growth to average 2.8% this year. This is NPR.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest needs no introduction to public radio listeners, but I won't let that stop me from reminding you of the crucial role she's played in the development of public radio and the progress of women in media. In 1972, when she became co-host of All Things Considered, Susan Stamberg also became the very first woman to anchor a daily national news program. All Things Considered broadened the definition of news, and Susan added a new dimension to the role of anchor. She sounded respectful, yet informal, whether she was talking to a head of state or her favorite novelist. There was often a surprising intimacy in her conversations. The force of her on-air personality helped put NPR on the map. Since leaving All Things Considered in 1986, she's hosted Sunday Weekend Edition and been a special correspondent for NPR. She returns to guest hosting Saturday Weekend Edition in July. Susan has a new book called Talk, which features excerpts of 20 years of interviews and her reflections on her work. I wondered what it was like for her to listen back to her early interviews. Had her voice changed over the years?
I was so formal. And in those early days, when there weren't a whole lot of women on the air, in fact, none doing news, I was the first to anchor a nightly national news program, 1972, with All Things Considered. We were imitating men, so I was lowering my voice to sound as authoritative as I could. And I hear in those tapes my getting looser and more relaxed with it. I hear in more recent work speeding up to a point where it's almost too fast sometimes. I've got to start slowing myself down again. I hear those changes in voice, voice per se, but also a growth of confidence, which I hope happens to you. I used to feel about radio, you keep doing it until you get it right. You know, you practice it every day and someday it'll kick in. And I hope that that happens too over the years.
Let's go back to, was it 1972 when you started hosting All Things Considered?
Yeah.
Okay, now the first time you hosted, it was a substitute.
Yes, I sat in.
Who were you filling in for?
I have to say, Terry, there's a lot of first women and feminist stuff in this book because I'm a believer in it. But men gave me breaks every inch of the way. And he wasn't the first host of All Things Considered. That was a man named Robert Conley. But he was the second one, I think, Mike Waters. Was doing the program, and at that point, I was hired as a tape editor, but at that point, because things were so open and possible at NPR in those days, I was also getting stuff on the air. He said to me, I really like your work. How can we hear you more? I'm going on vacation. Why don't you sit in? And it was that kind of generosity. He went away. I sat there. There was nice response to it, and poof, we were co-hosts.
As the first woman to anchor a national daily news show, were there complaints that the network got from either listeners or stations that carried the show?
There were. But you know something, Terry? I didn't know about it. I write about this in Talk, too. This is a story that I heard 11 years after the fact, and I heard it from Bill Siemring, who was important in getting you on the air. I know that when he was a manager of
absolutely.
Station.
We would never have become a national show if it weren't for Bill Siemring.
We wouldn't exist, All Things Considered, NPR, if it hadn't been for Bill Siemring. That's exactly right. He was our first, I think they called him program director then, and the man who really conceived of All Things Considered. And he told me this story 11 years later, that when I first went on the air, there was quite a bit of opposition, not from listeners, but from the managers of our stations who were worried on behalf of the listeners. A woman's voice is not authoritative enough, they said. women will not be taken seriously. A woman cannot do news. Now, maybe in those days, there was one little piece of it that could have been correct, and it was about the voice carrying. Technologically, we were not nearly as sophisticated as we are today. We had bad, staticky telephone lines over which we broadcast to the country. Today, we've got satellites, so things are clearer. And the bass band of women's voices is not as strong as it is in the voices of men. And so maybe my voice didn't carry quite as well as it would today, but that was about it. The rest of it was prejudice. Anyway, Bill never said a word to me. And this, to me, was such a remarkable show of the quality of his leadership. He knew if he told me. I was very sensitive about it all. I was nervous as heck. And it would affect me. It would throw me in some way. It would affect my work. And he had enough confidence in me to let me keep going, sensing that I would prove myself as I did it, and the criticism would go away. And it did.
So if you hadn't been protected from these comments, you think you would have been more insecure than angry?
Oh, sure. Well, yeah, it would have been a mixture of both. But I sure brought heavy bags of insecurity along with me, and very nervous and concerned. It was such an important thing to me. I mean, it was this network. It was starting. I'd done radio for some years, but I wasn't speaking to the country. I was speaking locally here on a Washington public radio station. So this, you know, it was a dream of those of us in public broadcasting for years, that there'd be this interconnection. We could talk to the nation. And here I was the one doing the talking. So, there was a lot. There was a lot of it.
Did anyone tell you that you sounded too New York?
Sure.
Did anyone ever say you sounded too Jewish?
Sure, yeah. No, they don't say Jewish. They say New York, and I always hear that as Jewish and maybe more than a little anti-Semitic. I certainly didn't and don't sound like people who are on the radio today. I really don't. I have a distinctive sound. And it is, you're right, I'm a New Yorker and I'm Jewish. There's nothing to be ashamed of in either of those. They're simply facts of life, and people have commented on it. Yeah, sure.
Your style, I think, is one that is very direct, very casual, very real. And that wasn't really the style when you started broadcasting. And as you said before, you were really trying to kind of put on this air of authoritative and sound like more male.
Isn't that funny?
to fit in. How did you start drifting away from that and becoming more of who you were?
Well, I in those days, in addition to doing all the broadcasting and most of the interviews, we had five reporters, so the hosts really did a tremendous amount on the program every day. I was also editing my own tapes. I mean, we had these skinny little skeletal staffs, so you had to do everything. And I think it was in editing my own work really taught me a lot. It taught me to hate that stiff sound that I was trying so hard to produce, to say I could hear how phony it was, and I just decided to stop.
Can you share with us one of the scary moments from an early broadcast of All Things Considered when the staff was small and the show was still being defined?
Oh, you bet. We had those every other day. The tape would keep breaking, or the tape wouldn't arrive in the control room on time. I can remember a very early program in which I introduced something. The tape went on the air, and the director, Rich Firestone, said in my head, said, "Wait a minute, the tape's on backwards. Phil," and threw my microphone on, and I talked and talked and talked. He got the tape, he turned it around, he ran it again, and he said in my ear, "Wrong. It's Russian. Phil again." It wasn't backward. It was a foreign language. And he put my microphone on, and I got to talk some more. I would come in those days, Terry, with reams of clippings and papers and books to use as film material, because I always knew something was going to go wrong. You know, I still do that, actually, tell you the truth. When I substitute for Mr. Edwards on Morning Edition or go in to do the Weekend Edition Saturday program live, I'll always take a little something with me, because you never know.
You hosted All Things Considered for, I think it was, 14 years?
Yes.
Why did you leave?
Oh, I left for a range of reasons. I've been wanting to get off that program for quite some time. It is an enormous grind. Noah Adams and I were wonderful partners on the air for 5 years, and the only thing, and we are dear friends, the only thing we ever fought about was who had the harder job in broadcasting, whether he did or I did, since we had exactly the same job. We had a good time fighting over for whom it was harder. I suppose it was for me, because I did it for so much longer than anybody else did. And that just was a lot of it. There was a tremendous kind of revolving door. in the staff, and that takes its toll on you. You know, people sort of moving through and needing to be trained up and needing to be taught radio and taught what it was we were doing. That can burn you out pretty quickly. I don't feel I ever burned out, but it was a conscious decision that I really wanted to get off that daily carousel, something that I wanted to do for some time. I write in this book really made the decision final was the fact that in 1986 I discovered I had breast cancer. It was treated. My prognosis is excellent. But that was the point at which I said to myself, okay, this is something you've wanted for a long time. Now's the time to do it. You don't need this kind of stress in your life. I take my work very, very personally, and I work awfully, awfully hard. And it doesn't come easily to me. And I just wanted to move that quotient of stress out of my life and do less. And I did.
How many people did you tell about the breast cancer?
Very few. I told family, of course, and a handful of really close friends, and only a few people, here at NPR who I felt needed to know.
Did you go through chemo?
No, I had a lumpectomy and radiation.
And you'd come to work after the radiation?
Yeah, I was working all through that and doing a piece which I adore, actually. It was a salvation through that time. I felt I needed to keep working. Work has been important to me at a lot of rough times in my life, as it is for many of us, I think. It was a piece about Beryl Markham. I had been the year earlier over to Kenya with a team from All Things Considered covering the UN Decade of Women's Conference and read on the plane on the way over this extraordinary book, West with the Night. She was just this extraordinary British woman who went over there. Her father was a Kenya pioneer, settled, became the first woman to cross the Atlantic Ocean the other way. I think she flew from London to Nova Scotia or something, solo piloting a horsewoman, horse breeder. And Peter Breslow and I worked on that piece all through the radiation. Beryl Markham saved my life, I think. She kept me going through that.
There must have been times when... after radiation treatment, if you'd go to the NPR offices, you'd really feel like saying to everybody, listen, you don't know what I've been through this morning.
No, I don't. That's not me.
Mm-hmm.
Long pause. The most compelling thing you can do on the radio. Keep quiet.
So you didn't?
No,
people did not need to know.
No, I didn't. I wasn't ready to do that to people, and I wasn't ready to handle their reactions to it. I'm a bucker-upper. It's part of my nature. I like to make people feel better. I'm the one that, in the All Things Considered days, when the program was being put marked up on a big map on the wall, I'd come in. That would start at 2:30, the order of the pieces and who was going to be reporting what. I was the one that would come up to that map and say, where is the joy in this radio program? And I did what I could to be the bringer of joy whenever I could to the air. And I felt that I didn't want to inflict this on people. And I also selfishly didn't want to have to cheer them up or make them feel better, which is a part of what happens with illness. People become very upset with you, and I feel a certain obligation.
So this was in 1986?
Yeah, 86.
Did you need something that drastic in order to give yourself permission to leave All Things Considered?
Well, I certainly hope not. I hope I would take better care of myself than that. This has been a long time in coming. We had many years of talk about it. I really was ready to get off the program and to move on. I've had some regrets from time to time. There's a kind of access that kind of daily broadcasting gives you.
The hosting All Things Considered must have been a very difficult position to walk out on, even though you felt like you really needed to do it. Because, I mean, you knew the impact you were having on people's lives.
It was very clear in my mind. Yes, I didn't like breaking that contract with listeners. It's a very important one to me, and it's something that I feel defines what a host is. They expect you to be there all the time. And so it troubled me, and I got some wonderful mail in the aftermath of that, and people who still tell me that they miss me from it. But I was going on to a wonderful new challenge, which was putting Weekend Edition Sunday on the air, and there was that to look forward to, getting moving something new on, and it meant doing it once a week, and that I welcomed enormously.
Are there things that you reclaimed from your personal life after you left A Daily Show?
Yes, sloppiness was one, and
great.
Yeah, it was wonderful too. I just felt I had to was always so super organized. You really have to do that and be that way in order to get the daily journalism done, as well as the family and all those other obligations. So I could just loosen up a whole lot in my life, and I think that was the greatest benefit to me, really was.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure you recognize my guest voice. My guest is Susan Stamberg, and she's just put together a new book called Talk. NPR's Susan Stamberg considers all things. It includes excerpts of her interviews from the past 20 years and a lot of behind-the-scenes stories about how she did those interviews and her memories of the people who she's spoken to. We're going to take a break. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. Susan Stamberg is my guest, author of the new book, Talk. Susan, there's something I want to ask you, and this relates to breast cancer, but it's much more about interviewing. I sense that the breast cancer is not something you're really interested in talking about in detail. The question always comes up for me, as I'm sure it does for you, how far do you go with somebody when there's something personal that's happened in your life that you'd maybe like to hear more about, but you have a feeling they probably don't want to talk about it more. Now, what's your general? How do you guide yourself when asking that question?
Well, I don't have a rule of thumb, but it happens often in this book. I see evidence of it, and I see an interesting development as well. A rule with me, and I think it's a current one too, is if someone starts crying, I turn off the tape recorder. It's why I wasn't meant to do journalism. I have all the wrong instincts. If it's that painful, they need to be private about it, and I don't need to record that, to broadcast that pain to others. If they can talk about it, it's one thing. I just hate when on television the camera zooms in and focuses, you know, the lens zooms in to show you the tears. It's none of my business. I turn away. But I've also, something else that I learned in going through these 20 years of material for this book is that people over these years, I've discovered that interviewing has become easier, not just because I've done it more, but people have seen it more and heard it more. I can remember in the early days holding a microphone out under somebody's nose, which I still think is kind of a rude gesture when I'm on the road. And having people back up and laugh self-consciously and say, oh, I don't know, you want to record that. That doesn't happen now. They're used to it. There is so much of it that's happened in these 20 intervening years that they know how to talk into microphones. They know how to be on television, and they know how to summon their strength in order to tell difficult things. I think I've also learned a lot about human resilience, and it's been something that's meant a great deal to me personally. I write that one of the things that cancer did was to affect my work and make me much more interested in people who faced up to something terrible and gone on with their lives. You don't understand what learning from someone's courage is until you need those lessons.
Susan, I know on those occasions when I'm interviewed, there are two parts of me that kind of go to war each time I'm asked a question. And one part of me is the professional part that's saying, well, as an interviewer, I ask people questions all the time, and I expect that they'll kind of reveal as much as they can and blah, blah, blah. And so I, too, should reveal as much as I can to the person answering these questions. And besides, I know that if you don't reveal a lot, you stand the risk of being really boring and there's no greater sin and so on and so on. Then the other part of me is saying, you really don't need to be very personal, and it's probably better if you're not. Because particularly as an interviewer, you need to be a kind of neutral person. Do you know what I mean?
I do know what you mean.
And not have you want to keep people guessing in a way, and you want to be able to draw on the parts of yourself that are most relevant to the interview that you're doing and so on.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't want to reveal too much. So these two parts of me go to war. Is there a war like that happens to you when you're interviewed? And do you know how much you're comfortable with in revealing about yourself, whether it's your health or you know, any other personal part of your life?
Yeah, I guess so. It's not so much a war as I It's not a war I fight anymore. I know what I will and what I won't speak about, and you hear the long pauses. So that's I know how to do that now. And getting older makes that easier. You know, Terry, my generation, we were raised as nice girls. Philip Roth says this wonderfully, too, and there somebody sends him an angry letter and asks him for lunch, and he goes. And I said to him, how come you went? Why did you do that? He said, I was young. When summoned, I went. Now, he wasn't raised as a nice girl, but I was. You're asked a question, you answer it. I don't leap to those answers quite as quickly now. Maybe I've learned a kind of privacy and a professionalism. And I also wonder, as I said, this sort of cult of personality has a short string as far as I'm concerned. There are other things to talk about. There are issues, there are ideas, there's wonderful writing to talk about.
I'll give you an example of something just that happened to me. I was interviewing Isabel Allende, mm-hmm. the Chilean writer now living in the States. And during the interview, she'd mentioned that her daughter had died. Not too long. No, I knew her daughter had died, but it turned out her daughter had died in December, just a few months ago. And I could just tell by the way she just, you know, said that parenthetically, that this was something that was still obviously really close to the surface for her. And then so I had to decide, well, should I ask her more about it, or should I just kind of change the subject
what
and move on?
What did you do?
I changed the subject
Good
and moved on. I just felt like, do I need to put her through
Good
this because she's written a new book? And I decided no. But in all honesty, on another day, I might have said, well, let me ask her something, and maybe then I'll pull back. Do you know what I mean?
I guess
it's a really, I think, difficult
it's
question.
It's a tough call. It's a tough call. But when you know the experience is very raw, you need to, I feel the need to let people heal from it before I go poking around in those depths of their lives. And I don't know what's to be served, really. I don't know what good it does to do it. And I don't want to make my living off the pain of someone else.
Have you ever wanted to stop interviewing?
It's real nice to take breaks. It was good to take the year off to write Talk. But I never want to stop asking questions. That's the real issue. It's not so much the interviewing. I feel I am blessed that I found microphones in this world because I spend my life talking to people away from the microphone. It's something that I do naturally as a person. I'm the one on the elevator who'll turn to somebody else and say, well, did you ever think that it would get as hot as it did this early in the year? You know, I'll just sort of do
yeah,
that.
But you know, in the elevator, people sometimes think you're a psychopath.
Yes, they
not
do,
a professional
but
interviewer.
I smile nicely at them and I reassure them that I'm not. But it's what I do. I'm always asking questions. I'm always curious. I'm always wanting to know. And luckily enough, I found a place where they'll pay me to do that. So, no, I can't imagine it.
So what's the fantasy? If you did stop doing interviewing one day, what would it be that you wanted to do instead?
Oh, I would just want to be a jazz singer so bad, sit in a red strapless dress with a slit in the skirt on top of a piano in some smoky bar. Can I sing? Is that your follow-up? Is your follow-up question, can you sing, Susan?
Listen, do I want to stop you? Absolutely. Go ahead. Go ahead.
No.
No, okay.
But I could learn. I could learn.
Susan, it was a pleasure to talk with you.
Oh, Terry.
Thanks so
always.
Much.
Always. Thank you.
Susan Stamberg's new book is called Talk. She returns to Saturday Weekend Edition in July. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. By the time writer Muriel Spark wrote her first novel, she'd been a 19-year-old bride with a doomed marriage, moved to Africa, endured a dangerous journey aboard a troop ship from Africa to England during World War II, and worked for British intelligence. Coming up, Muriel Spark tells us about her first 39 years, the subject of her new memoir. Spark is best known for her novel, The Prime of Miss Jean Brody. And Maureen Corrigan reviews King of Cards by Robert Ward. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Congressional leaders are still bargaining with wavering Democrats in the House, who will vote tomorrow in the president's five-year deficit reduction plan. While many fear voting for a new energy tax, conservative Democrats are demanding more stringent controls over spending. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold has more on the story.
A confident House Speaker, Tom Foley, told reporters this morning that there are enough Democratic votes in the House of Representatives to pass the tax plan, which is the core of the president's economic program. But throughout the day, there have been numerous closed-door meetings and lots of arm-twisting. While the energy tax poses a problem for some members, especially those from energy-producing states, a faction of conservative Democrats want more control of the spending side. Leaders are working on a way to write some assurances into the bill that if mandatory spending for such programs as Medicare and Social Security exceeds annual targets, the President and Congress will be required to find more spending cuts. Meanwhile, Republicans are lobbying hard against the bill, threatening retaliation in the districts of freshman Democrats who vote for new taxes. I'm Elizabeth Arnold at the Capitol.
In Germany, Parliament has approved a measure to cut sharply the number of refugees entering the country. The vote came after 13 hours of debate. More than 2 million people have entered Germany since 1989, costing the government billions of dollars every year and leading to a number of attacks on foreigners by rightists. Outside Parliament today, some 10,000 protesters demonstrated against the measure, at one point forming a human chain around the building. But lawmakers were brought in by helicopter and ferry. Some lawmakers question whether the bill will lower immigration or just drive it underground. In Washington, the Clinton administration has disavowed suggestions that it is pulling back from a foreign policy leadership role. NPR's Ann Garrels reports.
A senior State Department official told a group of reporters yesterday, given limited resources, the United States must define the extent of its commitment and make a commitment commensurate with those realities. He said this may on occasion fall short of what some Americans would like and others would hope for. The suggestion that the U.S. might lead less on international affairs follows Washington's refusal to act alone in Bosnia and its failure to persuade others to join in military action. The White House quickly insisted the U.S. continues to lead on Bosnia, and Secretary of State Warren Christopher told the Associated Press the U.S. role is undiminished. He said when American vital interests are challenged or threatened, the United States will act unilaterally if necessary. Christopher also said the U.S. would not be a superpower long if it had to do everything on its own. I'm Ann Garrels in Washington.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up more than 23 points to close at a new high of 3,540.16 on volume of 274 million shares. This is NPR News. UN officials say Croatian forces in Bosnia held a UN food convoy for 7 hours before letting it go, on condition that they get half the aid. The food was intended for Muslims in the besieged town of Mostar. UN officials say the convoy returned to Croatia, but will head back tomorrow and divide the food equally. A spokesman says the convoy was carrying 80 tons of food to thousands of Muslims, where the last food was delivered 11 days ago. UN diplomat Thorvald Stoltenberg met today with Bosnia's president, but he failed to gain approval for a UN-supported peace plan. Jeremy Bowen of the BBC reports.
A burst of shelling and machine gun fire greeted Mr. Stoltenberg when he arrived at Sarajevo Airport. Undeterred, he said that all the peoples of this area would be the losers if the fighting continued. He said he would be looking for common ground with President Izetbegovic and that he hadn't given up on the Bosnian Serbs either. But after their meeting, President Izetbegovic said he'd drawn Mr. Stoltenberg's attention to three bad points about the Washington plan. First, it couldn't guarantee the free passage of humanitarian aid. Secondly, it didn't say what the international community would do if the Serbs continued taking territory. Lastly, it didn't say how long the outside world would tolerate the Serbian occupation of land they've taken. President Izetbegovic said the world had an obligation to help the Bosnians because it wouldn't let them buy weapons. If that embargo was lifted, they would be able to solve their own problems.
Jeremy Bowen reporting from Sarajevo. The former commander of UN forces in Bosnia says the best way to find peace in Bosnia is to create a single Muslim area around Sarajevo. Louis McKenzie, testifying on Capitol Hill, said that this was the only way to end the fighting. Since other nations are not prepared to send in heavy military forces to Bosnia and to keep them there for years. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. My guest Muriel Spark is best known for her novel, The Prime of Miss Jean Brody, which was adapted into a popular play, film, and TV series. In Spark's new memoir, Curriculum Vitae, we learn, among other things, about the real teacher Miss Jean Brody was based on. Spark is the author of 19 novels and has also written for The New Yorker, where excerpts of her memoir first appeared. Stephen Schiff recently profiled her for the magazine and wrote, "Muriel Spark has written some of the best sentences in English. For instance, he looked as if he would murder me, and he did." Muriel Spark grew up in Edinburgh and now lives in Italy. The publication of her memoir has brought her to the States. I spoke with her earlier today and asked her about Miss Christina Kay, the teacher who she had at the age of 11, who inspired the character of Miss Jean Brody. Spark says she fell under her teacher's spell.
She was a marvelous educator. We didn't realize it at the time, but she just kept the whole class of 40 girls riveted the whole day. It rather made theater out of the whole school experience. She was dramatic in her way of presentation. She looked dramatic. She had large dark eyes, and she used to bring all her own personal experience right into the schoolroom and tell us that when we should have been having a history lesson or a arithmetic or something, she'd be telling us of all her experiences during her summer holidays, all the people she met and the wonderful time she had and the beautiful pictures she saw and the music she'd heard. And describing all this to us, it made us feel that we'd experienced it ourselves. I used to write poetry as a child about her experiences, not my own.
I found that very amusing when you said that in the book.
Yeah.
What kind of poems would you write about her experiences?
I would write about the beauty of the country, the Forum in Italy. I would write about the Switzerland and the snow and the flowers. I would write everything she told us, actually. And sometimes I'd write essays about it.
Your teacher was interested in Mussolini and fascism. How did you reconcile that with everything that you loved about her?
Well, we didn't know anything about it. She just brought these wonderful pictures from the newspapers of Mussolini marching on Rome with all his black shirts, and said what a fine fellow he was, how he'd cleaned up Italy. She didn't think for a minute that the same politics would apply in Britain because we had a monarchy. She didn't think we needed cleaning up, which in fact we did. And I don't think she knew quite what it implied. For instance, she didn't know quite what a dictatorship meant. She didn't think it through. She was just impressed by this big, bold man, you see. She was quite sexy. In the book, I rather exaggerate all these qualities.
I want to skip to when you were 19 years old, and you married a man 13 years older than you, who you didn't know very well.
Not very well, no.
And he was going to what was then Southern Rhodesia.
Southern Rhodesia. He went, mm-hmm. And I followed later.
Was this your way of having an adventure?
Yes. And I thought he was very marriageable, too. But I had made a really big mistake, and he had been rather remiss in not coming across with his medical history. He was a psychopath.
I'm not surprised he didn't tell you that.
No, but, I mean, he knew it and should have revealed some of his medical history.
Well, you started finding out about this little by little when you were in Africa
him.
What were the early signs that he was crazy?
He was violent.
Violent to you?
Yes.
What would he do?
Oh, just be violent. Knock me around. I had to go to hospital. However, I got out of that very quickly. I just refused to have anything to do with them and took the baby and got out of the way. And he was very lucid at times, but he just had these fits. But I said I wanted a divorce.
I'm trying to imagine what it was like for you. You were in your early 20s.
Yes,
you're in Southern Rhodesia. World War II is breaking out, and you're getting a divorce.
I was very angry and very tough.
Uh-huh.
I really was tough because I knew I'd been badly let in for something that I shouldn't have been. It wasn't my fault.
Right. So you got your divorce.
I got my divorce. Then I was feeling very ill, and then I couldn't bring my son back to England. But for the last part of the war, I came back to England to work.
Why couldn't you bring your son with you?
Oh, because it was too dangerous on the seas.
But you were willing to take that risk yourself.
Oh, yes.
You were so desperate to get out.
Oh, yes. I wanted to do some war work, too.
For the war?
Yes. Africa was a desperate country to be in. It wasn't nice.
What do you mean by desperate?
Well, there was a racial situation, and there was no tension politically, but in actual life, everyday life, there was plenty of tension. It wasn't a very pleasant situation at all.
Well, how did you feel as a young woman leaving your baby son behind while you took this dangerous voyage on the seas to England?
Yes, I didn't like that. A lot of people were leaving. They had to leave their children when they were posted home or anything like that in civil service. They were obliged to leave their children either in Canada, Africa, or in what was one of our colonies at the time, Australia. A lot of children were separated from their parents in wartime. Nobody took the children into the theatre of war.
Where did you keep your son?
Oh, he was with some friends and went to a convent school.
Mm-hmm. If you're just joining us, my guest is writer Muriel Spark, and her new book is a memoir about the first part of her life. It's called Curriculum Vitae. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. Writer Muriel Spark is my guest. Well, you managed to get to England. You I believe visited your family in Scotland, then went to London because you wanted to experience the war.
Yes.
You wanted to help England. You wanted to help the cause.
Yes, I wanted to be in the war, and I did get into the war.
You got a job with British intelligence. Why don't you describe your job for us?
Well, it was broadcasting to the pockets of German troops that were holding out all over the continent. Subversive propaganda. But we were broadcasting as a true and Hitler-loving German station, ostensibly. But, of course, we used to slip in a lot of subversive remarks and things like that to demoralize the German troops.
What's an example of the type of subversive remark you'd script in?
Oh, all sorts of... For instance, there was the bomb plot in 1944, plot against Hitler, where those generals failed to blow him up. But this was broadcast by us as a deplorable event. But they added that Hitler was saved, miraculously saved, which was true, and that he'd only lost his trousers. You see, this sort of is sort of to humiliate them and to make the soldiers laugh.
And when were you able to bring your son back?
Oh, just as soon as the war ended in 1945, as soon as the war in Japan ended.
What was it like to see him after?
Oh, it was nice. It was lovely, yes. And I took him to my mother and father, who were very, very keen to have him. And he stayed with them always.
So did they bring him up?
I commuted. I had a home. They brought him up, yes.
And how did he feel about that when he became old enough to realize that his grandparents were bringing him up more than his mother?
Well, he liked it. He'd rather have had naturally his mother and his father, but he couldn't have that.
You write about two religious conversions in your family. Let's see, your mother was Protestant and your father was Jewish. Your son, when he was...
No, my mother was sort of Protestant, yes.
Okay. And your son, when he was a young man, I believe, or a teenager, converted to Judaism.
Yes.
And you converted to Roman Catholicism.
Yes.
When you were how old?
I was about 32, 33, like that.
And why did you convert to Catholicism?
Oh, because I had been reading on Catholic lines for a long, long time. Great many people of my, just the generation before me and of my generation, people like Alec Guinness, Graham Greene, and long before that, Evelyn Waugh, had become Catholic. It seemed to be the normal thing for a writer to do and for an artist to do, because it gave you a stable base and a kind of point of departure
point
and
of
a point of return.
Uh-huh. Point of departure and return from what?
A departure and return from the Catholic faith. It was a fixed point.
So do you think the conversion helped your writing?
Yes.
By giving you that fixed point?
Yes. I was much more inspired and able to organize my work better. The question of organizing. I'd got my spiritual life organized as far as one ever can, and it showed in my work. You've got to really find yourself in matters of religion. Find what... I felt that when I became a Catholic, that I had been a Catholic all along, really.
How so?
I don't know. I just felt that. I felt that this is what I had always believed anyway.
Was it hard for you to get up the stamina to write your first novel?
Well, I had been ill. Yes, it was. But as I was writing, I realized that I was writing something quite new, quite different from anybody else's, and that gave me courage to carry on.
You said something about being ill?
I had been ill, yes. I'd had a nervous breakdown and through taking Dexedrin. And it gave me a sense of delusions of words jumping about on the page. Well, I went to a doctor, and as soon as the Dexedrin stopped, I got better. Those delusions went away. But I still felt rather ill. I was undernourished.
What had you been taking the Dexedrin for?
For appetite suppressant, because I didn't have enough to eat. I didn't want to feel hungry.
You didn't have enough to eat because you didn't have any money?
Yes.
Wasn't it expensive to buy the pills, though?
No, it was less.
The pills were cheaper than food.
Yes.
But so you got hooked on the pills. Did you realize what was happening to you?
No, I didn't connect it with the pills. I realized something was happening. Then when I went to an ordinary doctor, that problem was solved, but I was still left rather in a weak condition. And so I went to the country to write this novel, really about my experience.
Now, I know after you started writing, you lived in New York for a while, but after a few years there, you moved to Italy, where you continue to live. Was there something about New York that didn't agree with you?
No, it was. I was in New York 4 years, by which time I was working at the New Yorker offices, and it really was rather wonderful. But I found that the distractions were mounting up. Now, my play, The Prime of Miss Jean Brodie, the last year I was in New York, had been on the West End of London. And I had kept in New York. Now it was moving to Broadway with Zoe Caldwell. And I got out of it because I really found that the pressures on me of being a temporary celebrity of a kind were too much. I wanted to get on with my work, so I went to Italy.
What was too much about those pressures?
Well, just seeing people, people wanting to see me, great deal of pressure.
Mm-hmm. So you've lived in Italy since...
When you write a play. I've lived in Italy since 1968.
Is there any connection between living in Italy and your conversion to Catholicism?
Well, I think so. I used to love the churches in Rome. I settled in Rome first. I loved the churches, and living in a Catholic country meant a great deal to me. I felt at home.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Not at all. Enjoyed it.
Muriel Spark's new memoir is called Curriculum Vitae. This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams is with us. Noah, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Hi, Terry. There is a bit of anticipation in Washington today in the run-up to tomorrow's vote in the House of Representatives on President Bill Clinton's economic stimulus package. Republicans say they'll vote down the measure, and they'll try to make it hard for Democrats to vote for it. The man who has been Guatemala's ambassador to the United States says that yesterday's power seizure in Guatemala by President Serrano was totally without justification. Daniel Swerdling reports from Kenya on charges of corruption in that country. And Linda Wertheimer talks with a man in Pittsburgh who's invented a way to use hot pepper to keep barnacles off the bottom of boats.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. You know those desolate times when there's nothing good to watch on TV, nothing good to rent at the video store, nothing good playing at the movies? Well, critic Maureen Corrigan has been having one of those stretches when there seems to be nothing good to read.
I've read so many mediocre to downright lousy new novels lately. I'm beginning to think that May is to publishers what January is to retailers, a dead month in which nothing but limp merchandise is left on the shelves. I've been so discouraged by these dull books, I've even caught myself thinking the one thought forbidden to all reviewers. Maybe it's me. I wish I could say that Robert Ward's novel, The King of Cards, has broken this losing streak. But although it's a lot better than the clunkers I've been reading, I can't rave about it. As a cure for the book blahs, The King of Cards is like taking aspirin when what I really need is an antibiotic. The King of Cards, like Ward's earlier wonderful novel, Red Baker, takes place in Baltimore and opens with a fantasy I bet a lot of us share. Tommy Fallon, a native son of Baltimore and now a famous writer, has returned to his alma mater to receive an honorary doctorate. Being on campus again stirs up Tommy's memories of his confused undergraduate days in the mid-60s. Back then, he was torn between a loyalty to his working-class background and a fierce desire to transcend it by becoming an ivory tower academic who prefers Henry James to the Orioles. I'm partial to these updated How Green Was My Valley kind of stories, and so I was moved by Ward's descriptions of Tommy's struggle against what he calls the willed stupidity of his hometown. Quoting another native son, H.L. Mencken, Tommy rails against his fellow Baltimoreans, especially his parents. Tommy's father once wanted to be a painter, but his ambitions were destroyed by the Depression. Now he defensively ridicules Tommy's dreams by telling him that college is only for pinheads and fairies. Tommy's mother chimes in and tells him scare stories that are supposed to act as talismans against wanderlust. Ward pays these ordinary people the respect of making them complex and suggests they're greater than the roles required of them. And some of his descriptions of red brick, row house Baltimore neighborhoods are so lyrical, they reminded me of the late Irving Howe's great memoir about New York, A Walker in the City. But for some reason, Ward decided that this quiet coming-of-age story needed some zany characters, and so he has the young Tommy move into a commune populated by a con artist, a horny ex-nun, and a beautiful beat poetess. In other subplots, an autistic child is miraculously cured, and a mobster is laminated to death. Ay, ay, ay. In his acknowledgments, Ward thanks his editor, but I can't figure out why. His novel needed a merciless red pen. Dyspeptic culture critic Jonathan Yardley claims the decline of the publishing industry has wiped out that Maxwell Perkins type of editor who had the time to really fine-tune a manuscript. Much as I hate to agree with Yardley on anything, I think his is one theory that explains this crop of disappointing novels. King of Cards is certainly the best of the bunch, but that should be a greater compliment than it is.
Maureen Corrigan teaches at Georgetown University. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Joyce Lieberman and Richard Parker. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional grants are provided by the National Endowment for the Arts. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, the impact of the Holocaust on the politics of Israel and the identity of Israelis. We talk with Israeli journalist Tom Segev. His new book argues that some Israelis use the Holocaust to encourage Israeli chauvinism and aggression. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.